irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself a Job with Jennifer Hill. Today, we're going to be talking about how things have changed from the 1980s to present. But before we do that, I do want to thank our sponsors, the lovely folks over at Markham Search. Markham Search is a premier professional recruiting service that has offices on both the East and West Coast and services the continental United States and other countries as well. So thank you, as always, for our sponsors at Markham Search for making this show possible. And today we have with us on the show, Michael Schmidt. Michael is the vice chair of the firm's labor and employment department and the office managing partner of the New York Midtown office for Cozen, where he is also a resident. For more than two decades, Mike has concentrated his practice on representing companies and management in all facets of employment law. A substantial portion of Mike's practice is devoted to maintaining collaborative relationships with his clients and developing appropriate strategies to avoid litigation and minimize potential exposure in the area of employee relations. He has tried cases and argued appeals in both federal and state courts and has represented companies, non-union and union, in arbitration and before federal and state administrative agencies such as the EEOC, the New York State Division of Human Rights, the New York City Commission on Human Rights, and the Department of Labor, as well as OSHA and the National Labor Relations Board. Beyond his regular client practice, Mike serves as the chairman of the board of directors of After School All-Stars of New York, a New York chapter of a national charitable organization founded by Arnold Schwarzenegger in the mid-1990s to provide after-school and summer programs for inner-city youth. He also spends a significant amount of time providing pro bono counsel to various organizations and individuals who are less able to afford representation in times of need. Mike earned his undergraduate degree with honors from Brandeis University in 1990 and earned his law degree with distinction from Hofstra University of Law in 1993, where he was a notes and comments editor of the Hofstra Law Review. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. That makes me sound so good.
You are a pretty special guy. I love. I'm not going to lie. I love the philanthropic part of what you do. That really speaks to my heart, and I think it's so important that, you know, we can give back. We're so lucky to be able to do what we love and help people. But I think helping those less fortunate is such an important aspect of our lives.
No question about it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Mike, tell me a little bit about this. When you were a kid, were you growing up, and did you think, "Hey, I want to be an attorney"?
I think so. I mean, I don't have a real recollection of wanting to be anything else. I don't think I had any kind of passion for, you know, business and financial kinds of things. I always was the queasy one when it came to blood, so I wasn't going to medical school. So I think, I had some lawyers in the family, and I do think that, being a lawyer was something I thought about. I just didn't know really until much later what kind of law I was going to end up practicing.
So tell me a little bit about labor and employment. What wound up drawing you to the labor and employment field?
Well, it's actually an interesting story. I mean, I came into labor and employment quite by accident. I think a lot of times when you graduate law school, for most lawyers, you have a sense that you want to be either of one or two buckets. You either want to be a litigator, you want to go into court and litigate cases, or you know that you really don't want that, but you want to be sort of a transactional lawyer. You want to do deals, negotiate, whether it's real estate or corporate. I think those are two large buckets, but you don't necessarily know ultimately where you're going to fit in within each of those buckets. And when I first came out, it's now 25 years, which is amazing. In 1993, I started working at a small firm, and the firm started to get all kinds of employment-related complaints brought against their corporate clients, their general litigation clients, and nobody had really seen much in the way of these kinds of employment cases back then, at least in that firm. And since I was the low guy on the totem pole, they said, Mike, look into this, figure it out, and let's see what we can do with these kinds of cases. And I started doing a couple of them and really loved them. And the more you do, then you start writing your first article. And after you write your first article, all of a sudden you're an expert. And 25 years later, it's really what I've been doing exclusively.
That's amazing. So for some of our listeners out there who might be job seekers and some might be employers, let's just kind of give them a little bit of a recap. So somebody out there who's maybe in the job hunting world understands what a labor attorney does.
So essentially, and it's a broad field, but essentially a labor and employment lawyer is somebody who advises and, you know, represents their clients on issues having to do with the employer-employee relations. It could be some contractual issue between the employer or the employee. It could be the employee, the current or former one, who has a claim against the company, whether it's, you know, for violating some rights under an agreement, or whether it's some kind of violation like a harassment claim, a discrimination claim, a lot of the kinds of things that you hear in the news a lot about today. But essentially, it's a lawyer who advises and represents clients on all things dealing with the employer-employee relationship from hire to fire.
Got it. And so tell me, what has changed this whole concept of the 9-to-5 from the 1980s to present? What has changed in the labor world from back in the 1980s to now?
Well, I mean, the workplace and the workforce has changed so much just itself since 1980. The workplace doesn't really exist anymore for a variety of reasons, technology, I guess, being the primary one. We don't just have everybody working within the four walls of a particular office. People have remote access. People are doing work on smartphones and through other technology platforms. And they're not just doing it, as I said, within the four walls of an office. They're doing it remotely from home more than they ever did. They're doing it out of their cars. They're doing it, you know, in different places from around the world while they're traveling. So the workplace has certainly changed a lot since 1980, as has the workforce. We have, it's still not a perfect workforce these days, but we've made some good strides in terms of women in the workforce and the kinds of senior management positions that women have been able to occupy since 1980. We have an older workforce for a variety of reasons. People are staying at work much longer, either because it's a healthier workforce now in 2018 than it was in 1980, whether for financial reasons, people are just tending to work longer in their careers. So a lot of things about the workplace itself and the workforce itself as a starting point have really changed significantly since 1980.
And so what does that mean for employers? Say you have a company out there who's tuning in and they're saying, well, gosh, you know, Mike is right. We have a lot of our employees who telecommute now, and they might be working remotely in different capacities, full-time or part-time. How do we make adjustments, basically, to accommodate this new workforce?
Well, I'll give you a few examples. So when it comes to what's referred to as wage and hour regulations and rules, and that essentially just refers to companies having to pay employees according to certain rules and based on how many hours they work. And most people understand, they've heard of the concept of overtime. You know, putting very simply, if you're working more than 40 hours in a work week, you got to get time and a half. And there's all kinds of terms of art and rules that I won't bore the listeners with at the moment. But one of the things that has changed since 1980, for example, is the fact that people are working remotely and not in the office. So whereas it used to be in 1980, that employers were able to watch their employees. They knew when they came, when they went. They knew how much time they were spending working. Now, when they're not within those four walls, they don't have as much of an ability to monitor their work hours. So it's much more difficult, for example, to be able to pay employees when you don't necessarily know how many hours they've worked in a week.
Yeah, I know that's an issue we had recently with a temporary person in our own office, is that when you have people who work remotely, which is something we rarely do on the temporary side, it's hard to know when do the hours start and when do they stop. Do you treat it like a normal 8-hour day, hypothetically, the 9-to-6, and whatever hours you're there, because you have to be available to respond to the client's needs? Are those considered regular hours, even if you're not working the whole time? And how is the law, how does the law perceive that?
That's exactly right. And so what happens now in, you know, 2018, in this era of technology, when you're sitting at a Dodger game and in between innings, you're picking up your smartphone and you're checking emails and you're responding to your supervisor's emails. That work time. You didn't have to worry about that back in 1980, but it's something that if it adds up and it becomes more than a de minimis amount of time, it may be something that the employer better be cognizant of and better be compensating the employee if it's required to.
Yeah, it's funny, Mike. One of the reasons, honestly, that I wanted to have you on the show is because I remember pre being an employer and post being an employer. And I remember being yelled at by one of my very first bosses because I was an early bird. And I thought, if I'm a good employee, that means I'm going to show up at 6:30, even though my start time isn't till 7:30. And I'm going to show up and I'm going to do an hour of extra work because that shows how dedicated I am. And my gosh, I got my butt handed to me by the person who was my president at the time, who took my key back to the office and said, Jen, we found out you've been getting in at 6:30 a.m. And I'm like, yes, I am your best employee. And they're like, no, you're not. You just got us in trouble and we're not going to give you a key to come in the office. And I remember being dumbfounded as an employee going, why would they penalize their best employee? But now, having been an employer myself for 8 years, just when somebody says that, it's like nails on a chalkboard of, oh my God, you can't do that. And yet the person who's the employee doesn't realize the cost and impact.
That's right. And in many cases, it's the employer that has the problem with it, because if they're feeling as if they can't control the cost and they don't know how many hours the employee is working, or, you know, to be a little more cynical about it, what happens because they don't know how long the employee is working, that all of a sudden the employee claims, well, I was, you know, working remotely, working at home 70, 80 hours a week. There's no records that are being kept by anybody. And now the employer is either on the hook to pay that or is going to be on the hook for the cost of having to defend that claim for several years.
Yeah. And another,
you know,
one.
Sorry. Well, I was just going to add with the other part that's interesting about it is it's not really only the concern of the employer. The employees in 2018 feel that pressure as well, because they feel as if they can't disconnect and that they are expected to respond and review emails or other kinds of communications. And, you know, one of the interesting things to note, because it's not in the United States yet, but France, for example, is a great example of this, where they have instituted just last year within a larger set of labor bills something that's referred to as an email curfew. And that is that after certain time of day and on weekends and on vacations, an employer is not allowed to request or expect an employee to review and respond to emails. That hasn't made its way over the pond yet, although places like New York City and other jurisdictions around the country have introduced legislation to try to get that email curfew concept in place. But again, I think that's part of a larger work-life balance initiative that we have seen spread around the country in many different ways in 2018 and really 2017.
Yeah, I know that in California and New York predominantly, I think that we see a lot of these labor laws rolled out in states like California and New York to start, and then they kind of have a trickle-down effect to other states and cities and so forth. And I know that it has become, at least California, has become a very pro-employee place, which is great, where you now have things like mandatory sick leave, or you have to take your lunch hour or pay a penalty. All of these things, I think, that are great, and I love that France did that. I remember, wasn't it something like after 5 or 6 o'clock, you can't respond?
That's
great legislation, not just for the French, but for all of us, because you look at how out of balance we all are and how disconnected. We feel so connected via social media, Facebook, you know, LinkedIn, whatever different social media modems we might be using, and yet we're disconnected. A lot of scientific studies are showing how disconnected we are from other human beings, because we might be out to dinner with a spouse or a child or a friend, and we're checking our emails, and so there is no real connection there.
It's all about expectations, and how do you balance the expectations? And you just touched on a really significant and dramatic change when you talk about what's so different 2018 versus 1980. When we're talking about what it's like to be a labor and employment lawyer, what that meant really in 1980 and probably, you know, even 10 years ago, you had essentially a federal set of employment laws that you had to follow. It was the sort of source of these kinds of laws that we're talking about were very federal based. And people still in 2018 going back a couple of years when you had now a Republican President Trump coming into the White House and a Republican-controlled Congress, you had so many businesses and employers sort of throwing the party hats and the streamers around, all excited that, you know, wow, Washington is going to be so pro-business, pro-employer, it's going to be smooth sailing for us. But what we have seen in the last year to 2 years, principally, are a lot of these initiatives that we're talking about now coming out from the states and the local cities and the local towns. So it's not just about what's happening in Washington, what are the federal sources of labor laws requiring of companies, but what are states like New York, like California doing? What are cities like Seattle, New York City, and Chicago? What are they doing in this work-life balance area, such as, you know, these kinds of wage payment issues when we're talking about paid sick leave, paid family leave, predictive scheduling kinds of issues, all of these things that I put under the big umbrella of employer-employee work-life balance issues. You're seeing a lot more of those initiatives come out on the state and local side than on the federal side like you used to 10, 15, certainly 20 years ago.
Well, I think it's funny that we're talking about state versus federal. So for those of you who might be tuning in and saying, what are they talking about? Your state has certain laws that govern the state. But if I'm not mistaken, Mike, I'm not an attorney. Doesn't federal law trump state law, or am I mistaken on that?
Well, since you were nice enough to invite me on the show, I hate to tell you that you were wrong about something.
Well, hey, it's okay. My husband would agree with you.
But the answer is, in the area that we're talking about, as long as you, the state, or you, the local jurisdiction, provide the minimum of what the federal law provides, you can be more strict. You can require more as a state or a local municipality. So, for example, you see when it comes to things like minimum wage, where the federal government has had a minimum wage real low for a long time, and Congress has been trying for years to raise that, and it's been difficult, and if not impossible, to do that. Well, in come the states and these local municipalities raising the minimum wage, as we're reading about and tweeting about, to $10 to, you know, in some cases, $15, depending on the industry and depending on the location. So if you're not trumped, no pun intended, by the federal law, you will have to comply with the state and local law in those cases.
Well, let's play devil's advocate on that for a moment, because I think where I got that idea from was one particular area of law that became prevalent in California in the last few years. I'll never forget, I had a job seeker who was up for a position with a big company that had national offices, and they had a no drug policy. Well, this individual at the time, it was before weed was even legalized in California, when the time came to do the offer and the drug test came up, the gentleman said, well, you know, I do have a weed card for medicinal marijuana. Will that be a problem? And in this particular case with this company that had offices around the country, even though at the state level it was legally allowed to have a marijuana card, that prohibited him from being able to take a job at a certain company. So I'm curious how stuff like that works, where you have these states now. You know, I think Vermont may have just done it, and you have Colorado and California, and many of these states are jumping on the bandwagon. But how does that work if you have a company that has a tried and true drug, no drug policy, but then at the state level, California or Washington says it's okay?
Well, you managed to pick a very unique kind of area, because there's no question there are some areas of the law, you know, in some respects, employee benefits and executive compensation, in some respects, immigration kinds of laws. There are certain areas when it comes to labor and employment law where the federal law specifically refers to the fact that it will preempt any kind of state or local law touching on that subject. But when it doesn't, expressly or impliedly, then, as I said, you have to follow the state or the local law. But you did touch on an interesting area, and that is sort of the drug testing and the drug policy. You know, one of the things that's coming up lately, and I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that, is the sort of regulation of marijuana use. We are hearing a lot about and seeing a lot about all of these states and local jurisdictions passing, whether it's recreation use, whatever it is, allowing employees to use marijuana in certain kinds of cases. But what's fascinating about that is that marijuana is still, I think as you just touched on, is still a controlled illegal substance under federal law. So yep. There is this dichotomy. Why are we spending so much time passing these state and local laws, allowing them to do X, Y, and Z with marijuana when if they're caught with it and they're caught using it, it is a federal crime still.
I know, it's so, and I just remember being baffled, and it's been a very hot topic at most of the labor conferences that I've attended over the last 3 years or so, because there are so many unknowns. It's like the wild, wild west, I would say, not just in the whole area of weed law, but in so many areas of unemployment. Like I remember, I think San Francisco is notoriously one of the most interesting places to test out new policies. There was a crazy one I had heard like a year or two ago, and you would probably be more familiar with it than I am. And it had to do with people who were taking care of an elderly family member, like a parent or a child or something like that. They had to be given flexible work schedules. So I'm probably messing up the law around it. But I know certain areas are so flexible that employers and employees alone, like employees don't know their rights and employers don't know what is right or what's not. I remember last year was I was at my third labor update of the year, and the attorney leading it said, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you will never be able to comply with all of California's labor laws. The bad news is you will never be able to comply with all of California's labor laws. And I was like, that is great. I'm selling my company.
No, that's the irony there. It's true. We are seeing that across the country. And, you know, you named another one, the sort of predictive scheduling and the temporary scheduling. And, you know, New York City and California, and I refer to them as countries, really not states, because they have been so on the fringes for so many years. California in particular, New York City is just becoming much more in the way of California in the last year or so. But you're seeing things like that, where government is coming in and doing a lot more regulating of the workplace and of the employer-employee relationship. And part of, you know, part of what's interesting to me about all of these issues is, you know, yeah, it's terrific. We would all love to have a minimum wage set at $100 an hour. We would love to pay employees of all jobs as much as we can. But, you know, is there a consequence? Is there an impact, you know, an unanticipated consequence when you continue to raise the minimum wage? Are you unfortunately forcing employers not to hire as many employees? And so does it become somewhat counterproductive by just continuing to force them to raise the minimum wage? And you can ask that same question when you're talking about all of these other kinds of forced benefits, whether it's paid sick leave, whether it's paid family leave, whether it's the predictive scheduling, and you're forcing costs on employers if they do not tell employees with a certain amount of advance notice what their schedule is going to be. You're sort of taking the business judgment, the flexibility out of the employer's hands and making it more difficult for them to run their business because of how much government regulation there is.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that we're talking about here, we have this whole conversation about minimum wage and what to pay people. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm more familiar with California labor laws than I am with New York. But if I'm not mistaken, I think it was October of last year that New York rolled out their salary law prohibiting employers from asking for salary history. And then California rolled out their Equal Wage and Pay Act, if I'm not mistaken. Again, you probably know this better than I do. January 1st of this year, which prohibits employers, again, it actually makes it illegal, if I'm not mistaken, to ask an employee about their salary history. Am I
right
with that?
It's a salary ban initiative where so many states, and it's had a lot of traction over the past year, where they are banning employers from asking applicants in particular what their salary history is at prior jobs. And so when I talk about how we've seen initiatives, this balance, this work-life balance between employees and employers generally, there is this subset within the past year of women's issues. And the salary ban issue is part of that, you know, pro-woman initiative, where we are trying to deal with the difference between what a woman makes versus what a man makes doing the same work. Because what the intent behind that salary ban is, if a woman has been paid less than a man throughout the course of her career, by allowing an employer to ask for that salary history and then make a payment and a compensation decision based on that history, all you're doing is perpetuating the difference in pay between women and men. So the intent was, we're not going to allow you to ask applicants what the prior history was in your compensation so that we can make our own decision based on your qualifications, based on your experience, and not based on perhaps a discriminatory pay decision that was made in prior jobs.
You know, I would love to pick your brain on this for a minute, because I've been seeing so much disparity in how employers are handling this, at least in California predominantly. And that is that, you know, per the, at least the California version of the law, you are required to provide a range for the job if requested by the potential job seeker. And so where I'm seeing a lot of confusion, both on the employee and the employer side, the employees have no clue what to ask for. They say, well, gosh, what do I do? Do I ask for this? Do I ask for a range? Is that too pushy? I know somebody in my personal life recently who had a company that was based out of China that outright asked him in the interview, you know, how much are you making or how much were you making? And he didn't know what to do with it, because he's like, okay, well, the company is based in China and they might not be familiar with California labor laws. So I'm curious on your opinion, because, or then you have the employer side where they give a range, but then they might go outside of that range for a candidate. Any advice to employers or employees on how to handle that tricky question?
Well, it certainly is difficult. And I mean, I think the first bit of easy advice from the employer side, particularly when you are an employer, either international or domestic, but you are a multi-jurisdictional company, it is critical now in 2018, unlike what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it is critical to know your jurisdiction and figure out, you know, if I've got employees in Seattle, I've got employees in Orange County, California, I've got employees down in South Florida, what are the laws when it comes to hiring and firing and everything in between in those specific jurisdictions? Because you might be able to ask a particular kind of question during the application process. You might be able to look at some aspect of the applicant's background during the application process in one location, but in another location, you could be completely precluded from asking the question, or you could be precluded from asking the question until you get to a certain phase of the hiring process. So the best piece of advice, the first piece of advice for any company who is operating in multiple jurisdictions, you know the laws in the jurisdictions in which you have employees. And it doesn't really matter in many cases whether it's one employee or whether you have the one employee who's working at his or her home in the jurisdiction. So that's the first thing. And I think from there, you've got to navigate the kinds of questions that you're asking very gingerly. You should assume, if you're staying abreast with these kinds of issues, you should assume in most jurisdictions that things like prior salary, things like credit standing, things like other kinds of protected characteristics are topics that you really need to shy away from, and you need to be focusing more on the actual job requirements and that person's experience in meeting those job requirements.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And what I say on the flip side, when this law first came out, I wrote an article about it on LinkedIn just to help educate employees, because I find that they're very confused about how to handle it. Somebody might say, well, Jennifer, does that mean I can go in and ask for $100,000 if I'm making $40,000? And what I tell them is, yes, you can absolutely go in asking for $100,000, but there are a couple things to consider. One is that if you go in asking for $100,000, you better be darn sure that you're going to generate $100,000 or more worth of value for that company. And what does that look like? And two is, if you go in asking for $100,000 and you're above market by 10 to 20K compared to your peers for some reason, then you might be in a position to be the first one to be let go if the salaries aren't comparable to other people. So there's just a lot of considerations on the employee or the employer side. And I feel like everybody's just kind of bumping into things in the dark, trying to figure all this out.
Oh, there's no question about it. And I think as the employee, you can assume that the employer is going to be more diligent without the ability to ask directly the applicant, you know, what he or she has been making in prior jobs, you know, is going to go into the hiring process much more equipped to know what the market is, what the value of this position is, so that they'll be able to determine, well, based on your experience, maybe based on the way you're answering certain substantive questions, you know, are you going to be providing the kind of value that we need to compensate what you're asking for? So sure, you can go in asking for, you know, $500,000, but either they're going to shy away from that from the get-go because they will know that that is so out of whack based on, you know, what they're looking to have you do, or you're really putting a target on your back when you get there, that you better produce and better produce what you've promised that you're going to produce early on, or you're going to be an early casualty.
Yeah, and one of the suggestions I make to people is that, say you think a job might pay $100,000, but maybe you're rusty or you don't have 100% of what they're looking for. I think we're always better off to go in asking for $90 or $95 and then have it built into your contract or to your employment letter or offer letter or whatever that looks like, to request then the possibility to sit down with your supervisors either at the 3 or 6 month mark for a potential review of an increase. So that way you've given yourself adequate time to prove yourself rather than just going in and, like you said, having a target on your back.
Oh, sure. Particularly when, you know, when you're an applicant and they don't know you from Adam or Eve, as opposed to when you've now shown some value and you've demonstrated some value to the company, it's far easier to then have that discussion. You know, this is what I brought. This is what I think I will be able to continue to bring. And here's why I can justify this raise after 6 months. Or, you know, let's make the promise now that after 12 months or after 18 months, I'll be able to do it. It's far easier to do that than to swing for the fences during the application process.
Yeah, and set up one or another party for unfulfilled expectations, because that's where you get into resentment, frustration, and being terminated, quite frankly. So nobody wants, the employer does not want that, and you do not want that. It's a lose-lose situation for everybody.
Totally agree.
So, Mike, I mean, obviously, there are so many topics, you know, aside from just California and New York and just across the country that we could talk about labor-wise. Are there any other points that you would love anybody out there tuning in today to be able to take away from today's show that might be a little learning point for them?
Sure. I think, you know, we touched a little bit on the whole concept of technology and social media, and I love talking about that. And I can talk about how social media and technology have impacted the 2018 workplace for hours. But I think one of the takeaways that's worth taking away, whether you are on the company side or whether you are on the employee side, is to understand that while things have changed in 2018, we have emojis that we use to communicate. We have, you know, nonverbal actions through social media, such as the like button on Facebook and otherwise. Things have changed through technology and social media, but that does not mean that the rules of the road that have been around in employment law for so long cease to exist because we are not within the four walls of the office or because we are using a different platform or a different means of communicating. You know, we may not be at the physical water cooler in the lunchroom, but we may be at the virtual water cooler communicating with a coworker off hours through social media or through text or some other electronic communication. And if you're engaged, for example, in inappropriate harassment that way, it doesn't mean it's any less unlawful or inappropriate just because you're using a new means in 2018. So it's important to understand what the rules are and how the rules have changed from a purely federal scheme to state and local initiatives. And it's also important to understand and take away that 2018 has brought so many changes to the workplace and the workforce, but let's not neglect the rules that have applied for decades.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I didn't even think to scratch the surface of that. We could do a whole separate show just on social media. I remember being enamored when I heard it first getting discussed at a labor conference a couple of years ago, and just the cost and impact it has for employees and employers. I think it's such a double-edged sword that we take for granted and we don't even realize the implications it can have for us personally and professionally.
Well, both positive and negative. I mean, look at the, you know, the hashtag MeToo movement. And again, you and I can spend hours just talking about that. But it didn't get started by the horse and buggy, you know, regular mail letter being delivered to someone. It was started on Twitter. It was started with a hashtag MeToo. And look what that has done to the dialogue. Look what that has done to both federal, state, and local as well, laws and regulations on sexual harassment issues just in the last 6 to 10 months. So social media and technology has had a tremendous impact. People can debate whether it's always positive, whether it's always negative, but I don't think you can debate that it's been a substantial impact for both parties.
I completely agree. Well, it sounds like you have a lot of great advice beyond just what you've shared with us today. So tell our listeners if they want to tune in to, I believe you have your own podcast, or if they want to get information on how to hire you or get additional insights from you, where would they find information on that?
Well, sure, and I appreciate that. I am, as you said at the beginning, I'm at the law firm of Cozen O'Connor. We are around the country. I am based in New York, but our labor and employment department and the rest of our firm are around the country in about 29 offices. From my standpoint, I also do have an employment law podcast. It's called Employment Law Now. You can find it on iTunes if you just search for Employment Law Now. If you really want to have it easier, you can just go to employmentlawnow.com and download it. It's a free podcast, and I try to keep it educational and entertaining at the same time.
That's awesome. I know I've learned a lot just from having this conversation. I learned I was wrong, which happens from time to time, and I acknowledge it.
Now you'll make me feel bad. That's your takeaway from the whole thing?
No, I'm just kidding. It happens so rarely, Mike. I mean, I got to appreciate it when it does. I'm totally kidding.
Of course.
But I love that. EmploymentLawNow.com. And I'll go ahead and make sure to have that included on our iTunes page for Get Yourself the Job, as well as on the LATalkRadio.com website. So that way, in case anybody missed any portion of this show, you can find Mike's bio, a little recap about the show, and I'll also have a link to where his podcast is. So if anybody wants additional information or to sign up for that, we'll have a link on our page as well. So it's been such a pleasure to have you on today, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a really great. So thanks again for joining us today. And I invite you to tune in next week at 4 p.m. I've had a lot of requests from people about resume writing, this whole idea of a CV versus a resume, which is which, and what should you be using? So join me next week at 4 p.m. with Michelle Lando, who is a certified professional resume writer, and we will get into the down and dirty of what your resume should or should not look like. So thank you, as always, for everybody out there tuning in and wishing everybody a wonderful rest of your week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.